are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 6, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Post correspondent Dave Weigel. On the California primaries and more. Meanwhile, with those primaries over, Dems still on track for a big November. It appears Dennis Rodman is the sanest member of the North Korean Trump team. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions reiterates that he is a moral monster, as the UN says, stop separating families. Mitch McConnell cancels the Senate recess to destroy our judiciary, or at the very least, remake it in Antonin Scalia's image. Mexico joins the trade war against the United States. Donald Trump celebrates America by forgetting the lines to God Bless America. And good news, Facebook sold your data to the Chinese government. Unsurprising new poll, 7 out of 10 Americans sick of the news. For those three of you who are still here, you're much better than those other people. And lastly, poor Fox can't seem to monetize Donald Trump. All this
suckers.
All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, big primary night last night. I'm a little bit, I'm exhausted. I stayed up a little bit probably later than I should have. And then, of course, Saul woke me up at 4 in the morning, and I could not go back to sleep. So just another classic day at the Cedar household.
Just picture Saul like wake, be like, in your face! Ha! No sleep! Like, just taunting you.
No, he's not. I don't think he's even aware of it.
Of course not.
Well, no, not of course not, because Mila would have been aware of it.
Oh, yeah.
Mila, definitely, like, that was her attitude.
Shave and sleep, Offie.
Yeah. Mila would wake up the next morning and go like, if you don't let me play more Fortnite, you won't sleep again.
Sounds great.
Mila did tell me, when we told her years ago that we were moving to Brooklyn from Manhattan, her response was, she was probably 7, maybe 8 years old. She said to me, if you ruin my life, I will ruin your life.
Jesus, that's such high drama.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And, I mean, scary.
And she did.
Scary threats.
And scary. Mission accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I tell her every day. That's what kids love to hear from their parents.
It's like, you ruined my life. Look at you.
Did you
pick them up when they were babies and say, you ruined my life?
No, I waited till they could understand what I was saying. Folks, just a reminder, this show relies on its members for its existence. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com, and as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra footage, content, however you want to call it, almost daily. In fact, daily. I don't know why I say almost. Like maybe 3 days out of the year we don't do that. And if you're interested in the fun half, but you don't have the resources, as always, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Give us some time. It takes us a while to get to emails. But no one will be locked out for finances. But again, if you're one of those people who were fortunate enough to be in a position to pay for a show you like to listen to on a regular basis, please help support the show. Join themajorityreport.com. Now, as you know, Donald Trump, and we spoke about this yesterday, there was a story out in February. I think it was Axios or some insider Politico journal type of situation where they said that the White House was very determined to run their 2018 election on cultural issues. In fact, the first one cited was something like the NFL and more black athletes kneeling. And here we are. Now it is June, 5 months later, 5 months out from 5 months out from the 2018 elections, and Donald Trump is still at it. I think this one fell flat, folks, and that's what I was saying yesterday, that there was just a little bit too much of a, like, it was just a little too, they're trying too hard here. Can't force these things.
And gotta be organic.
They disinvited the Philadelphia Eagles to a celebration at the White House because apparently the vast majority of the Eagles football players, something like, I don't know, was it 50 guys on the team? And something like 45 of them said not interested. And I should tell you that all 45 are not all people who kneel. All 45 are not all black people. In fact, they're so desperate to make it look like that was the case. Fox News put pictures of Eagles kneeling, presumably during the anthem. But it turns out they were just like some Christian players on the Eagles who kneel to God.
Bad look for Fox.
Bad look.
Whoa.
They just kneel before every game to pray, I guess, so that God takes it, you know. I guess the prayer is something to the effect of, like, God, know that there's some problems in a place like Yemen, or that you there may be some hunger that's
the
happening.
Eagles are praying well this season.
But just give us, like, you know, an hour, or, you know, even like two quarters would probably be enough. And that's basically the prayer. So here is Donald Trump. They have canceled the Eagle celebration and instead renamed it, what are they, like a celebration for America and patriotism. I think that was the name of the celebration. And what they did is they filled it full of White House staffers, as they are wont to do. Apparently, somebody went around and asked some of these supposed Eagles fans who the quarterback of the Eagles was during the Super Bowl, and like a half a dozen of them had no idea. And Donald Trump insisted on being put front and center in this salutation to America and patriotism as, I guess it was a Marine band, played God Bless America. The only problem, he did not take time to look at what the words were.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join us in honoring our country by singing God Bless America.
Do you think he's thinking right now? Shit, I forgot to look at the words. He gets the God Bless America part right. Love, he got right.
Well done, boys.
He does. Hold on, pause it. Go back. He says, stand beside me. Look at his lips. He says, stand beside me. That's right.
I like the nods now. Yep.
It's my another words nod.
Everybody's singing it well. I
know prairie, so I'm going to say that loudly.
Everybody else is singing well. I don't want to distract from it.
Picking my spots.
Oh, here it comes.
What a sweet part.
watermelon.
Do you think he can't say sweet and he's like afraid of like his
Schlul?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. He wouldn't say sweet. Could you really forget that it's home sweet home?
No, it's very.
It's too hard to say sweet.
Dad said don't ever say home sweet home. Dad said don't say home sweet home because it's gay. And then he hit me and then we went into a black space together. And then mommy said no, but then she got hit too. What?
Should we connect this one? Yeah, okay. So, and then meanwhile, as everyone is there celebrating America and patriotism.
It's actually during the song.
Oh, this is during the song. Yeah. A Swedish journalist who had a video camera captures one guy in this audience. Now, remember, these are all staffers, except for, I guess, apparently this guy. Watch what happens when it pans. Everybody's standing up. Everybody's standing up. And, oh, except for that guy. During the anthem, he's taking a knee.
Tell you what.
We just took his name down.
That would be a ballsy way to quit the Trump administration.
He definitely looks like he's got to be one of the IT guys, right? Well, would you say this?
So Jesper Zolk of TV2 Denmark reported that the man left shortly after kneeling and did not give his name nor say anything.
Yeah, he sounds like an IT guy. That's what it looks like to me. He's the only person there with a beard. And he looks like he looks like an IT guy. And he's probably, he knows he can leave, not give his name, and nobody knows where he goes or who he is. And they never see him.
Looking forward to the sassy Trump version of that.
Oh,
gonna need that soon.
That's going to be excellent. All right, look, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dave Weigel, who, as far as I know, has been in California literally for a couple of weeks. Covering the primaries. And I think, on balance, pretty good results. We'll be right back after this. You got a reaction. You got a reaction, didn't you? You took a wild orchid. Took a while, I can't turn that blue. Something better than nothing. Something better than nothing is giving up. You need to do something. Try keep the truth from showing up. How dare you? We are back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Majority Report. And as you know, the woods are dark and deep. We have many hours to go before we sleep. And as such, it is it's my pleasure to welcome to the program the Washington Post political correspondent, Dave Weigel. And Dave, you're in California right now, aren't you?
You know, I actually just got back. It's pretty easy. There's lots of planes. They're the only depressing thing is that you have to leave California when you get on them. But I got back to D.C. after about 10 days of heavy driving around very large suburbs, like the kind that 70 singer-songwriters wrote about and warned us about that have only gotten larger since.
So, all right. So, and you were, I feel like I saw tweets from you literally like 5 hours ago or 8 hours
ago.
Yeah,
I don't sleep very much. Yeah.
It sort of feels like you don't. All right. So you've been in California for 2 weeks. What was obviously it was the primaries, but what was the primary agenda? And I mean that not actually the primaries, but the biggest agenda for the Democrats in these primaries. I mean, go ahead.
It wasn't very complicated. It's expensive, but not complicated. They had some good candidates in seats where they had not competed seriously ever. I mean, like these were districts drawn to be fair, but they were districts where compromises had been made. So, you know, in Orange County had a couple of Democratic seats, but then mostly Republican seats. And then Hillary carried basically every seat in Orange County in 2016. So they wanted to just get decent Democrats into the November runoff. And I hopefully don't need to re-explain top two, because, boy, we explained that a lot last week.
Right.
And that was their goal, and they succeeded. I mean, this was probably the biggest hurdle for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, America's favorite committee, over the last, really, in the cycle. I mean, their biggest mission was not getting locked out, and they succeeded in not getting locked out.
So I guess there were 10 races where they thought that there are potential pickups, and there was like four or five that people had some measure of concern that they would get locked out, and they got locked out of none of them.
Yeah, I just was talking to the Republican counterparts about 10 minutes ago, and they're conceding that they probably didn't lock Democrats out of anywhere. They got, actually, the closest was, in the end, the seat that Democrats had stopped worrying about, which shows you actually how smart they were with their investments. Because in the 10th district, it was like Modesto and conservative Central Valley, but with lots of Latino voters. They barely made the runoff because they had four decent Democratic candidates and two Republicans. And then in Orange County, there's basically a district that kind of covers Fullerton, has a bunch of college students. They got Gil Cisneros there in Dana Rohrabacher's seat, which was the one they were most worried about, really up until about 1 a.m. California time.
Wow.
They probably wound up getting this guy Harley Rauda, who's a investor and former Republican who's become more of a progressive Democrat. And then in the 49th, which is Daryl Issa's seat, they feel extremely good about this guy, Mike Levin, who is a environmental lawyer, not with a ton of personal money. He's not the profile they want in every district, but who really impressed people, organized a good campaign. And the 49th is interesting because, as far as I can tell, this is a seat that stretches from kind of the La Jolla part of San Diego up halfway to Orange County. That district has never, ever voted for cast more votes for Democrats than Republicans in a primary. And it did last night. It was only about 48% of voters voted for any Republican in that seat, which is insane. It was more like 63%, just 2 years ago. It was 63%, in the last midterm. It was like 53, 54 in 16. So more people voted for Democrats in that seat than when Hillary and Bernie were on the ballot, which is they're feeling really good about that.
Well, all right, let me just reiterate what you're saying just so that it's not confusing for people, because because it is a primary that essentially has, I guess they call it, a jungle primary, but it's everybody votes. It's very similar to a general election, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, except for there are two winners.
It is, yeah.
And there are two winners. And so to have Democrats have that much more of a turnout than, I mean, that's basically what it is. It's just Democrats turned out in bigger numbers than Republicans. And that is an anomaly.
Yeah, it's an anomaly, except it's repeating what happened in 2016. And one thing I kept hearing from Republicans in the district. I mean, they were more realistic than some Republicans you meet, like the president, who thinks that they're going to, you know, gain seats in the midterms. But they kept saying, well, look, Scott Bowe, who was running against Dana Rohrabacher and trying to lock Democrats out there, said, look, you know, 2016, there was a decision not to compete in California. The president never came here. If it was up to me, maybe we'd have had some rallies, but like that Democratic advantage is going to be hard for them to repeat. And they didn't, I think overall across Orange County, we're still waiting on final votes. It was probably about 50-50 or maybe like 52% of all the votes were cast Republicans. It should be something like 61-62 if they were back to the normal midterm turnout. And that is terrifying to them. They really were kind of hoping that Democrats were boxing themselves out. They also, I mean, all the one thing all these candidates have in common in these swing seats is they've never run for anything. There is no Democratic bench in Orange County because they only recently started to compete there at all. And so they seeing that for them, I think, is has spooked them since it started happening last night. Because they're even looking at one thing we were all talking about in California at the end of the last week was you could track early voting and see what members of which parties have turned in their ballots. And it looked like Republicans were turning in at a higher rate. This is why Democrats were really panicking about that Rohrabacher seat for this reason. And in the 39th, they were panicking about that. It turns out, you know, a lot of those Republicans returned ballots and voted for Democrats. So a little bit less worry about that now.
Oh, really? So those early Republican voters had voted Democrat.
Some of them did. I mean, the Rohrabacher case is actually kind of one I know the best because I went to that district. It's literally where the OC took place. It's Newport Beach and Laguna and Huntington. I went there last year for Memorial Day weekend, and Rohrabacher was totally convinced he had no challenge at all. And this guy Harley Ruta, who's probably the nominee. I mean, they might be a recount. He was slugging away, raising money. And so Republicans were so worried about him that they ran this. They were running mailers and tweets and things reminding voters that Ruta used to be a Republican. He gave money to like John Kasich and the RNC and stuff. And the Ruta people think that didn't end up hurting them. I mean, there are people who, like Ruta, were Republicans for Mitt Romney and for other Republicans until Trump took the party over and they've bailed. And, you know, going around there, I mentioned the show, the OC, you see it everywhere. You see these pockets of like Teslas and Lexuses and people who've been doing really well and are mostly fiscally conservative, but are really horrified by, let's say, anti-gay policy, anti-abortion policy. And they seem to be converting in 16, and they stayed converted this year.
Interesting. And I should say these are not going to be in some respects we're seeing.
Yeah.
I mean, are we seeing like sort of like a revival of blue dogish new Democrats? I mean, that's what this guy sounds like to me.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, is that basically.
That's what's interesting is that in some places they didn't always nominate the most progressive person.
Yeah.
The people who were not running as the progressive candidate were tacking pretty closely to the left. For example, Ruta, I remember one of the first questions I asked him a year ago was, do you support Medicare for all? And he has an answer I've started to hear more from kind of rich candidates. It was like, look, I've done business around the world. Those countries that have universal health care are more competitive, so I think we should be getting there. You know, if you're a progressive, you're angry that he doesn't say, I'm going to co-sponsor 676 and have a hunger strike until it passes. But no, he was rhetorically for universal Medicare. Cisneros was also a little bit, he's really a former Republican lottery winner who became a Democrat. The more attractive part of his bio that the DCCC loves is that he's a veteran too. You know, he didn't say I'm for Medicare for all tomorrow, but he said we should expand health care. No one ran as a blue dog budget cutting conservative. I mean, the exception, there's a couple of people around the country like Jeff Van Drew, who won in New Jersey last night, is a blue dog. The blue dogs backed him. I sat down with another Democrat running Arkansas who's a blue dog yesterday. There's a couple of those, but in these California seats, it's like they made the jump not from right-wing Republican to blue dog, went from right-wing Republican to, like, you know, to like median Democratic member, to like Tim Kaine, I guess. Like, wow. they went that way. Because I always ask, you know, I'm always on the lookout for somebody running as a Democrat who's not a Democrat in any way. There were a couple of those guys running, and they just got smoked. I mean, there was one guy who I really came to love because all his mailers had pictures of him and Barack Obama just because he met Obama once. I was running as the fiscally conservative Democrat, the Eisenhower Democrat, and he got like 4% or something.
Wow. And what do you know about Katie Porter up in California's 45th?
Yeah, that's another race that's going to be a test of my favorite thing, which is whether people in D.C. know anything. Because Porter is a attorney. I think one of the attacks on her is going to be that she's not barred in California, but she's never claimed to be. She's more of a bankruptcy personal finance attorney who works around the country. She got in early as a progressive Elizabeth Warren candidate. She literally worked for Elizabeth Warren. Warren endorsed her. Kamala Harris endorsed her. And she ran against Mimi Walters, who is represents Irvine, so a ton of college students, and thought she was just completely safe. That was another district. All these talking about voters voted for Hillary over Trump in 2016. And so she got in early. There was recruitment that got this guy, Dave Min, who was also a law professor at UC Irvine, but was running more as a center-left New Democrat. And she beat him. She got into the runoff with Porter. You could already see last night some people in D.C. saying, well, boy, this is bad for the party. They're nominating somebody who's running on Medicare for All instead of somebody just running on the public option. That's where we're at now. And yeah, Republicans, even last night, I'm looking at my email now. That was a good 3 a.m. Eastern time.
Right.
Weren't saying, oh, boy, single payer is going to be – no, that's not going to fly in Orange County. You know, they're going to try, but Porter is she basically has Elizabeth Warren's policies and is convinced. I mean, when I was talking to her over the weekend, one of her campus launches, she was saying, I'm people here are much more angry that Mimi Walters voted for the tax increase, the tax cuts, because for wealthy people in California, they're an increase, lots of those wealthy Republicans. And then on single payer, she's like, this is going to save people money. I'm for this. I'm happy to explain to you, boy, this is going to save the money. Whereas my opponent voted to take your health care away or make it more expensive by voting for the AHCA. Do you remember that acronym?
Right.
The American Health Care Act, yeah.
That was the rollback. I guess that's what they finally settled on, right? With the and that was the rollback of the Affordable Care Act, but it was America care, something like that. America.
I'm only disappointed the word freedom did not get tucked in there somewhere. The American freedom to choose American health care and stand for the flag act of 2008. But no, that might be what they rename it, because this is still something I hear from Democrats all the time. There are Republicans who insist they want to try to get another Obamacare repeal vote before the midterms, and Democrats are delighted because they think it would fail. And they think the best they were ever doing in polling was when people saw, you know, a vote for a Republican equals ending the ACA. So they're like, bring that on.
That's not going to happen, I mean, that's not going to happen, right? I mean, there's no...
Probably not. I think there is going to be a push in the House to do it again. And you're going to hear, like, Ron Johnson, Ted Cruz say they should do it again. But my only point when it comes to Katie Porter is she's saying if it's a choice between I support universal health care, let's debate how we get there, to my opponent wants to get rid of the ACA. She's like, I'm going to win that argument, even in a conservative district.
I mean, I don't know. The Overton window is one of those phrases. It gets a little bit overused. But
yeah.
But it does feel, I mean, let me ask you this. Does it feel to you, having gone out there and look at these campaigns, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that to the extent that concept is real, it's moved. Like, the center of the Democratic Party has moved to the left.
I think so. And so this is rhetoric that I think for a lot of people watching the primary sounds like you're doing the work of the DCCC. You're being paid to say that everything's going great. It's just hard to avoid. I mean, I've covered this stuff pretty closely, and I have some questions I always ask people. In general, I have not found any Democrat. Let's say the Democratic position in 2014 was often in a swing district. It was like, well, we all agree that the ACA is not perfect, but we need to preserve it. And there was nothing about expanding it or lowering the Medicare enrollment age or none of that stuff. There certainly wasn't a lot of Medicare for All. And so completely, like, the candidates who beat, like, the Bernie Sanders PAC candidates in a lot of places, they're, at the very least, they're saying, we need to get to universal health care. And so if you're a cynic, and, you know, that's, I think, a very good thing to be, you can say, well, what's my proof that these people aren't going to get elected and do nothing to get there? I mean, that's fair, but the window has shifted in part because Democrats have seen how popular it is to run on expanding health care. This Virginia, honestly, might be the biggest story of the month, where Virginia, after a big election for Democrats, even with Republicans controlling both chambers of the Congress, they expanded Medicaid.
Right.
Yeah, as with work requirements, all that. But, you know, like the AFP, the Kochs, had been working to stop that successfully for 8 years, and the resistance just kind of collapsed. You're seeing the same thing in Maine. And so if you are a very cautious, I just want to preserve my career Democrat, at the very least, you look at that and say, gee, it looks like taxing rich people more to pay for more Medicaid is very popular. Like, whatever you think of the policy, that is more popular than, hey, everybody, guess what? You're going to pay a heavy penalty if you don't buy insurance from Aetna. That seemed to be less popular in the long run than, you know what, we're just going to make rich people, like, skip the one yacht payment so that you have free health care. That turned out to be more popular. I think that's why you've seen it move. Combination of ideology, combination of practicality, combination of just the biggest factor is just, wow, I win elections if I promise to give people health care.
I mean, I think that's just the idea that argument about electability has been sidelined, I think is pretty huge because there's just not a lot of energy, it seems to me, on what when you start, you know, and I'm projecting out to 2 to 4 years when Democrats control the Congress and then maybe have also control of the presidency. There's not a huge amount of energy on the we've got to maintain where we are policy shops. Right. Like anybody who, you know, once you have settled the electability question, then it becomes an argument about policy. And I just don't think that there's a lot of, you know, sort of money pouring into the policy shops that are advocating, you know, I don't know, we finally figured out how the public option would work and we're going to save, you know, Obamacare. I don't know. I just seem that that's going to be unlikely. We're not going to see that, I think, for a couple of years because everybody is in sort of this like policy, stasis because, of course, nobody's going to pass anything. But it's interesting to see that electability question be resolved. I guess the next question is, are people going to credit these moves on health care if the Democrats do end up having the big wave in November, or they're just going to say it was a generic wave?
I think it'd be hard to avoid seeing what they ran on. And in these races, Republicans are going to run against the threat of Democrats raising your taxes to pay for health care. Like, they were pretty explicit last night. I was, again, talking to Republican strategists when they saw that Katie Porter was going to win, and they're insisting, like, that's, you know, you tell voters that she wants $32 trillion in spending on health care, and, you know, she can't get out from under that. So Republicans are going to force the issue. They're going to portray the Democrats as radical, et cetera. Honestly, I always worry, you know, wonder if I'm being a Pollyanna, because I look at the arguments and say, well, that makes sense, and then sometimes they're wrong. But one of them is that the main thing Democrat candidates are doing to avoid being tagged as liberal is just by saying, you know what, when I get there, maybe I won't vote for Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
And that's such a big part of the Republican campaign that I think they risk wasting a lot of time demanding these people go after Pelosi and not you know, it takes some doing to explain to people why you should be against Medicare for All, and they're not really doing that yet. They've got 5 months, but so far their messaging has not been about that. I think in part because they don't have a great healthcare response. So it's the kind of thing I think is going to be litigated in the elections. And then look, obviously, one of my favorite I always use that word sarcastically. Time magazine covers was in 2006 when Democrats win the House. The cover of Time magazine is not Democrats win the House and Senate. It's a picture of a blue circle and a red circle, and it says back to the center. And it's just about how the story of the election was these Democrats moved back to the center. And, you know, the Rahm Emanuel was in charge, and there's this pretty clear narrative that Democrats had recruited a bunch of suburban businessmen and veterans, and they're just want to get things done. Whereas Republican rhetoric led by Trump is that these people are all socialists. So, like, I don't know. I think some of that's going to trickle down. But I'm saying at the same time, there'll be Democrats running on what would have been very left-wing policies in 2016, but they're going to say, and then if elected, I'm not voting for Pelosi. And I feel like Republicans are accidentally letting them get away with branding themselves pretty effectively by just saying, look, you know, that liberal you don't like, I don't like her either. And people are like, okay, well, you sound pretty good on this tax Rupert Murdoch more to pay for my health care. So you seem like a moderate.
That's interesting. So it's there's a little bit of live by the sword, die by the sword. You're gonna talk about Nancy Pelosi and San Francisco values. You never really outlined what those were, aside of, I guess, like an affinity for rice, pre-made rice dinners, right?
Like rice products. Expensive housing. Just Democrats love expensive housing. Yeah, I don't know. I pay lots of attention to these ads, and the ads are not everything, but in ads and direct mail, they've just, like, it's just assumed that people hate liberals, and they haven't really adjusted to how Democrats are moving up in the total vote.
All right, and so in terms of the statewide races, how big of a deal is it? And we don't, I guess we don't know in the Senate race who the top two were, yeah. Right? That's still, it's either.
We kind of know that it was Kevin DeLeon who made it into the runoff with Feinstein.
Oh, is that clear now?
Well, that's what it looks like at the moment. And there can be surprises, but generally in California, all the votes that come in at the last minute, they slant more towards Democrats.
Okay.
Especially in a year like this, where you've got just Democratic voters were trying to decide between people in a lot of key races. So, you know, DeLeon is about 90,000 votes ahead of the closest Republican, and you're probably going to get another 500,000, maybe more ballots turned in, and they don't think that's going to skew Republican.
So now, I don't know if I would love it if De Leon had a big shot or a good shot against Dianne Feinstein. Maybe he will. Maybe he won't. But for the for the sake of our purposes, in terms of right now, what does that do? Does that have any measurable effect because of what happened in the governor's race, where we have just Newsom and Cox, where we have a Democrat and a Republican in the governor's race? Does it make a difference that the Republicans were shut out of the Senate race? Because, and I'm just thinking in terms of turnout, like, does anybody, has anybody, you know, figured out some type of algorithm that for every non statewide race that is not taking place for a party, they lose X amount of turnout? Has anybody figured that out yet? Or is there, I mean, do you have a sense of that? Because I imagine if I'm a Republican running for Senate, the dollars that I'm going to spend, I may not win, but it's going to bring some voters out. I don't know if that's going to be, you know, 5 voters or 500,000 voters or what, but that's going to make a difference to down ballot races, won't it? Or no?
Yeah. I don't know what the latest political science on that is. It's there are enough cases, especially there are states where one party or the other has been kind of falling into disrepair, and they don't nominate people for every statewide office. There are examples where a party is nominated just like a kind of weak, cruddy candidate for the biggest election that day, and their base doesn't turn out at all. The number one case people point to this decade was Nevada, where in 2014, Governor Brian Sandoval was very popular, And Democrats kind of nominated a scrub, just someone's on the ballot, and they lost, like, everything. They lost control of both houses. They lost statewide offices that they thought they were safe in. And then 2016 comes along, and they gain it all back. But so the governor's race, I thought, was one of the more interesting game theory experiments in the state, when the election was entirely about game theory experiments, because you had the scenarios people saw were, well, we can have Gavin Newsom versus John Cox, the Republican, or we can have Gavin versus Antonio Villaraigosa, the Democrat. What Democrats in the state preferred was Newsom versus Cox, and this is not them spinning afterward because that's what they got. Like a week ago, they were telling, this is mostly labor union folks are saying, look, if it's Newsom versus Cox, like after 2016, no one says that guy can't win, but it is kind of a weak carpetbagger candidate who won't get anyone excited to be on their base, and Gavin's going to raise $100 million and beat the hell out of him. If it is Villaraigosa, the former mayor of L.A., he had was putting together a coalition of, you know, Latino Democrats and Republican donors. Like, he ran a ton of ads, millions and millions of dollars of TV ads attacking Newsom, funded basically by the charter school industry.
Wow.
And labor could not stand him. And what they worried about was in November, whatever was happening to turnout, they were going to maybe spend $100 million just to beat a fellow Democrat for governor. And that money instead, you know, maybe turnout was going to go up, but they would rather be spending that on the ground in Orange County, electing members of Congress, electing state legislators, things like that. And so this was the scenario California Democrats kind of wanted. I think just, until he loses an election, like a midterm, there's still this mystique around Trump where it's like maybe he knows something about John Cox. But honestly, I think a buried story from the elections is the political incompetence of Kevin McCarthy. Because McCarthy is, as far as we know, the guy who convinced Trump to get in for Cox. And again, this is the runoff situation Democrats were not at all afraid of. He has the Trump endorsement. Good for him. It's a state where Trump's approval is probably 22%. And then McCarthy, at the same time, endorsed a Democrat in the ISIS seat, endorsed a Republican, made it known which Republican endorsed in the 39th, the old Ed Roy seat. And those endorsements helped Republicans separate their fields so that Democrats could get second place. So in all these cases, they kind of did something what they thought was clever, and Democrats are like, gee, fine, okay. You just set up elections that we're totally comfortable competing in.
You know, it's interesting because back in the day, before Kevin McCarthy ascended, I recall the profile of him or people reporting that he was not a bright guy and not particularly good at what he does, as I guess when he was the whip. And you don't hear that as much. This is really, I guess, maybe his first sort of political test as majority leader?
I think that's fair. So in 2010, he's fairly new to Congress, and his job is recruiting people to run for House seats, and he does a great job. But it's the kind of year where even some people who don't have any business winning, like Joe Walsh, where even they can win.
Right.
So his reputation is based still on recruiting people. It is not based on, like, vote counting, which is more relevant to the job of being a majority leader. He is notoriously bad in clutch votes at getting them together. And so this election, yeah, it is the first time he is, you know, Paul Ryan is kind of taking one for the team and raising a lot of money on his way out. It frees up McCarthy while raising money to kind of focus more on candidate shaping races. And yeah, this was not the best situation for them in California, but McCarthy kind of thought it was. So there is some head scratching about what their strategy was going into California. Like the dream was in as many as four races, Republicans would set things up so that Democrats were locked out completely. And we would be all talking today about how the House got further out of reach and Democratic Party's in disarray and needs to fire its campaign team. And instead, they're like, they look fine. The Republicans look pretty mediocre. So with every advantage of incumbency, that's not amazing. There was a lot more going on than McCarthy But I was just struck from being in California how the political maneuvering he was doing was exactly what Democrats wanted. They're like, yeah, go ahead. Make sure that, boy, pump up this Diane Harkey in San Diego. We're really worried about her. Oh, no. Now we're in a runoff with her and somebody we think can actually win. Dang. Like, they just, it was a lot of, you know, the scene in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory where Gene Wilder is just saying, no, Veruca, please don't do that. Yes. It felt a lot like that.
And so as you were leaving and it was clear that the Democrats had not been locked out of the state, what were California, folks in the know, were they starting to predict how many seats they could pick up in the fall? I mean, assuming everything stays sort of more or less as it is today.
I think they're still nervous about how you win in the Central Valley. So there's 7 seats that voted for Hillary that Republicans hold. They all know that statistic. They know the pressure. They think the Orange County stuff, the way those votes are breaking, is promising for them. And the Central Valley, less so, but they're hopeful that, you know, a campaign where Gavin Newsom can run against John Cox as Donald Trump's clone, it might be the kind of thing that turns out Latino voters. So that's the story of the Central Valley, is there's just a ton of Mexican-Americans who can vote in these elections, who are citizens, but like just don't vote in midterms. And so they're cautiously optimistic that this will put that together. They're more optimistic in Orange County because I've already seen just this Democratic wave that started in 16 has continued. You know, the example I kept looking at last night was Mimi Walters again is the Irvine that is a race where the Democrats were not going to get locked out. It was just a primary where it was Katie Porter versus some moderates. Walters was on TV on Fox explaining that Democrats are in real trouble. And they really liked watching that because in her district in 2014, 68% of all votes were cast for Republicans, and then last night it was down to about 52.5%.
Wow!
So and Republicans say, "Well, that's more." Yeah, I mean it is, but that the Republicans had convinced themselves that just this Hillary versus Trump was a one-time thing. You're not going to repeat that. Once voters have a clear choice again, they're going to go back to the party. And the fact they haven't, Democrats were watching Mimi Walters last night and being like, "Well, one we know that we have these growing electorates in Orange County, and we know that the Republicans are in denial." So, I mean, they didn't make a number prediction last night, but basically in all 7 of the seats they wanted to compete in, they think they can. I think they'd be ecstatic if they win 5 of those. I mean, and, you know, whatever is better than ecstatic if they win 7. But they wouldn't say, here's the number we're going to win. They're just going to say, the goal was have good candidates in scoring position in 7 districts, and we did that.
What did you hear about anything about the 120,000 voters who were left off the rolls? I got a text from a buddy of mine in Glendale, and he's like, I've been voting at this place for 15 years, and they had on the rolls the lady who lived there in 2003, and so he had to do a provisional ballot.
Yeah, so there was panic about that for about 2 hours, maybe 3, in part because that was affecting 2 races they were competing in. It was affecting the 25th district against 25th against Steve Knight, which is like kind of the end of L.A. County going into Simi Valley, and then the Cisneros race in the 39th, which little slice of L.A., mostly Orange County. And they worried maybe this screwed us, and then it clearly wasn't going to screw them, so they stopped worrying. But they didn't fix it. I mean, like LA County is completely run by Democrats. It reminds me a lot of the Brooklyn voter purge 2016, which people still talk about because the theory there is the conspiracy theory there, I should say, is that the Clinton forces that run New York rigged it to lock out Bernie voters, which is not actually what happened in Brooklyn. Brooklyn's very diverse and voted for Hillary in the primary. Not sure if it would again. It's a bit like that, where it just looks like there was bureaucratic incompetence. I'm not in LA anymore. I'm kind of rooting for LA Times and other reporters to figure out what happened there.
Right.
All I know is, as a political matter, Democrats were not super worried about it. because they control the county. They can revisit this. And the worry last night was just that Latino voters, who they had to work really hard to show up for a primary, because it's, again, it's not the pattern of voting, that maybe a couple thousand showed up, they were on the rolls, and they went home.
Right. And we may not see them return to the polls in the fall because
yeah, I mean it's a habit. You get used to voting and you vote a lot. That's just like one of the boring and sensible policy things out there. So any election where you get people through LA's wonderful traffic and they go to the polls and they're told they can't vote, that's like yet more work for you in November. So yeah, they're not happy. I'm kind of blathering because I'm waiting for every reporter to figure out.
Races across the country, though, that sort of cut through the noise and through your I don't know.
And Democrats nominated progressive women everywhere. In New Mexico, Deb Haaland, who will be the first Native American woman in Congress, they thought she was in trouble. She ended up winning by about 10 points in this three-way, it was like a six-way primary with three serious candidates. In Iowa, which is one of six states where a woman has never been elected to the House, Democrats nominated women seats, and are feeling very good about, they're feeling very good in June. So they've done that before, and they're wrong, but they're feeling very good about winning at least one of those. And then in New Jersey, they nominated not just the candidates they felt most electable. I mentioned Jeff Andrew, who is a blue dog, who if he gets to Congress, I think he's going to really irritate the left. He had an A rating from the NRA, for example. But what I noticed in New Jersey is that there's three districts where there were competitive primaries in both parties, and historically Republicans have held the seats. And in all three, the Democrats outvoted the Republicans. So it was overall Democratic turnout in the state was – Republican turnout was up about 50% from the last midterm, which is pretty good, and Democratic turnout was up by about 110%.
Wow.
And so that keeps happening. And a colleague of mine was joking with me last night. It's like, every week we have this Tuesday night, we have Democrats worried. Wednesday morning we have, wow, they did really well. And then by Friday, somebody puts out a generic ballot poll where we're like, is it all over for the Democrats? So I'm waiting for that Rasmussen poll to drop on Friday. It's like, turns out they're not winning. Everyone stop being excited.
Is that a function of those polls not capturing the proper and who knows what the proper model is, but the disparity being the polls are not lining up with what we're seeing in terms of turnout?
I think that's exactly it. It's just that polling is taken on the chin. It's mostly accurate. The good ones are anyway. But it assumes it models this universe of turnout based on the last few elections. And if what we're seeing is basically every Democrat angry and voting and Republicans falling back, there's not really a poll that captures that. So if you love polls, I think the thing to check out would be Monmouth, which is doing some House race polls and has started, the Times did this in 2016 too, where they will honestly just release like four different versions and say, okay, here is the poll based on our model for how we started the year, the normal midterm model. Here's what it would be if there's a Democratic turnout surge. Here's what it'd be if it looks like 2016. And so the first one they did was Pennsylvania's first district, which is like Bucks County, right between Philly and New Jersey. The model for the normal midterm Democrat was down by 6 points. The model for excited Democratic electorate, they were up by one. They're not everyone is doing those. There are fewer polls than ever, fewer good polls than ever in some ways. That's kind of a way to look at it. And but I look more at these primary results. One, they're more definitive. They tell us more. But they're proving there's just this idea that Democrats had to deal with in 2017, too, that like, oh, the party's divided and maybe people are going to stay home and what do they stand for, blah, blah, blah. And then you just spend any time on the ground and you enter this room that's Democratic needing to turn people out, and it's like six times bigger than it has ever been before. It reminds me, it's like 2010, but without a recession. It is the same kind of voter anger at Washington all on one side. And that's hard to poll. California, you know, we know that it takes forever for them to count the last absentee votes, these provisional votes in L.A. I mean, look, there's more people who were left off the rolls in L.A. than voted, period, in Montana yesterday.
Right.
So when those votes are counted, we'll probably see overall like in a state that already swung pretty hard to Democrats in 16, we're probably going to see, you know, them gain relative to that. There is probably going to be, you know, 65% of the statewide vote was for Democrats. And yeah, that is a better model. Maybe then a poll will come out and says, oh, they're tied. It's just that on the ground, these campaigns have been beyond just good at turning out voters. They've been about, hey, the president's unpopular. You don't like him for all these various reasons. I, a Democrat, will expand health insurance, protect Planned Parenthood, and rebuild infrastructure. And that's like working with people so far.
All right. Let me lastly ask you this then. I mean, I'm sure you've read the Intercept reporting on the battles between the DCCC and more progressive candidates. And then there was that Theda Scotchbowl and Lena Putnam that had a similar dynamic, but it seemed to be less an ideological story and more an inside outside story. Who, mm-hmm. when you go into these rooms and you say like, wow, there's just, this thing is overflowing. There's X percent more than should normally be here. Who are the people who are making up that X percent? Does it change depending on where it is? Or is there a demographic? Is there an ideological, is there an ideological difference?
I like that you mentioned Theda Scoffel because she's pointed out that it is a lot of suburban women who are not radical per se, but are basically pretty liberal. That's the people that's the surge you saw. So, one of my big memories from the last week is going to a Harley Ruta canvas launch in Laguna Niguel, California. And it is a extremely nice house with like a view that looks like it's on House Hunters. Like a pool and fancy bakery products and a bunch of Lexuses in the parking lots. And everyone there is a Democrat. They weren't a Democrat 10 years ago, but they're so angry at Trump and right-wing policies that they're going to go in for Ruta in this election. And so it was not, in other words, like the Bernie people from the campus who came over. Those people are working on stuff. But they were there already in 16. They're still there. The new people are the kind of quiet Hillary voters who weren't doing activity. They're now knocking on doors. And it again, as somebody who covered the Tea Party closely, it reminds me a lot of that. It reminds me of that, but without a network on TV telling them 24/7, please go out and go to Tea Party rallies and then vote for Republicans. Like, these are people who I find part of their motivation when I talk to them is they're so frustrated that no one, as far as they can tell, there is no one around them. There is no one who agrees with them until they go to these meetings to help elect Democrats. You know, it's like the cliche is, I started doing this because I was tired of yelling at my TV. And the thing with Republicans is like, well, you can yell at your TV or you can change the channel and Fox is going to tell you, hey, everything's going great. The libs are getting owned. NFL players are getting humiliated. The president's the best president ever. Don't worry about it. Whereas liberals have no channel to turn to that's like, you know what, it's fine. Just, make some s'mores and have a good election. Everything they see is making them terrified. If they turn on NPR, they're terrified. If they turn on MSNBC, they're terrified. One thing I've noticed, I've talked to some Democrats who are watching Fox for the first time to get them extra terrified. You know, it's like how you slap somebody before the fight to get their blood going. And so this is a theory I'm coming up with as I talk to you. But I definitely find it's like, it's not people who are super radical. They're not going to join the Revolutionary Communist Party. I mean, I was in L.A. Over the weekend for a Bernie Sanders rally for criminal justice reform and overflowing, you know, huge crowd in the street, huge crowd inside. And you saw the Bernie 2020 shirts and all that. But you saw kind of like ordinary people who just went to this, bought $6 blue bottle coffee to bring in and were happy to volunteer, but they were the kinds, who would never have gone to that stuff 6 years ago, and now they're engaged. And so I think it's basically the story of the normies, and that's why I still think the project for the left, which has been pretty successful, is when the normie gets involved in politics, that they're running on a progressive platform. They're not running on a let's fix the debt and make people agree with each other. They're running on more left-wing policies. And again, circling back to what we said at the beginning, that I'm finding that to be almost universally true.
Dave Weigel, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and who knows, super sleuth. There's been a lot of talk. There's a lot of talk about you, Dave, working for the company, as it were. We don't want to say anything else. But
I'm just going to quietly hail Hydra over here and see and talk to you later.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on, telling us about this, and probably sending out coded messages to who knows who. But
yeah, I mean, I was blinking in Morse code. I'm not sure if I got over on the radio.
We'll do our best to try and pick it up. Thanks a lot, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half. Honestly, I don't think that you can get a more comprehensive report on what is going on on these campaigns than to hear from Dave Weigel. I mean, if somebody wants to even email me or nominate someone who they think does more actual, like, first of all, the guy does not sleep, I don't think. Because when I woke up last night after Saul had peed his bed and started yelling at me about it, and I can't fall back to sleep, and I'm like, don't pick up your phone. Don't pick up your phone. But I still have in the back of my head, like, what happened in the Senate race? Yeah. Like, you know, do we lock out the Republicans in the Senate race? So I pick up the phone and I get on Twitter as I will at 4:30 in the morning or whatever. Five. And I'm seeing Weigel tweet. And I'm like, if he's still in LA, it's two. Like, what, where? He's supposed to do the show tomorrow morning. That's in seven, you know, that's, I guess it would be, yeah, 7 hours his time. And apparently he was on a plane too. I don't think the guy sleeps.
It's a corporate MSNBC DNC agenda, which you promote every single day on this fake independent show.
There you
go. It's disgusting.
This is
Washington
basically
Post, Jeff Bezos, CIA smearing Jimmy Dore.
What's what I?
You ought to be ashamed of yourselves if you were even capable of shame. Well, you're a bunch of fucking corporate sellouts.
Astute listeners of the show. We'll pick up that we did not have an advertisement today. And that is, of course, because when we have Weigel,
company underwrote it.
When we have Weigel, we're fully funded by the CIA that day.
Yeah. Oh, that's another Langley day. Let's have Weigel on, smear the progressives. Get a nice check from Langley.
Here we go.
Meanwhile, oh, you just laughed. It'll have war with Russia. It's that, disgusting.
And you know why? You know, When we start having Weigel on more, then you know that the Pentagon has gotten a good Venmo account because they can just zoop it right into our folks. Just a reminder,
like energy about why, like you just can't think of like a less. I mean, I guess you could, but he's not a polarizing persona. Like he's a journalist.
I mean, he can be snarky on Twitter.
He can be snarky. No, that's why I said I hesitated there. Of course, I could think of he has a personality, but it's just funny. Like just a reporter.
But honestly, I don't know.
Actually, treats the left incredibly fairly for a national reporter for a place like the Washington Post. It's just like, there's the guy.
I would be curious as to honestly if there is anybody has even a nomination for a political reporter who actually travels more and goes out and actually like talks to people on the ground and gets that's the way they do their reporting.
No, I mean, I think Daniel Marin does a really good job in the Huffington Post. Is kind of in the footsteps of Weigel, but yeah, I mean, he's a very good reporter.
So just a reminder, folks, on days when we're not supported by the CIA, your membership makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And again, if you do not have the finances, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will take care of you. And today is Wednesday, ladies and gentlemen, June 6th, which means that unless we have traveled through some type of
time
dilation. Space.
Dilation,
or I was going to say wormhole, or I can't remember what it was. We've crossed some type of time-space plane. Yesterday was Tuesday, which means that last night was Tuesday night. And according to my calculations, that would have been the Michael Brooks show evening.
It was a great show.
And it was apparently it was a great show.
Yeah, it was.
Alona?
Alona Minkowski. When, that was just very funny. Alona and I had a good time. And then Assad Haider on his new book, Mistaken Identity, which is a really smart book on this identity politics debate. From the perspective of black radical tradition.
And you can check that out on our YouTube channel or on iTunes or both. Frankly, subscribe to the show on iTunes, then check it out on YouTube. And then, of course, the Patreon, patreon.com/TMBS. And Matt's new podcast has launched to great fanfare.
Good show. Strong out of the gate.
It's perhaps the most erudite show that anybody in this room has ever been involved
with. Yeah, but we swear and stuff, so it's like casual.
Casual.
It's like casual but researched. This is why it only comes out twice a month. It's
well, I mean, are you suggesting this is not research?
No. Well, you know, I mean, it's research in the morning. I mean, you do a lot of research.
<All right>. Sam, how do you think I did on Monday?
What's that?
Nothing.
Oh, yeah, you did very well. You did very well on Monday, Brendan.
What are we talking about?
I got
about
what
Monday?
You were saying. And don't worry about it. Do your research.
Okay.
Yeah, Matt's show. I like that, though.
Oh, yes, yeah, Matt.
I just don't want people to think it's too stuffy. Brendan was super good.
No, actually. Matt's show's like, hey, that was like what fucking Graham Greene was pointing out. It's like colonialism from a literary perspective. Don't be a fucking bitch.
There not that much swearing.
Literary Hangover, folks. You can find it on iTunes. Literary Hangover. And you guys have a Patreon too, right?
Patreon.com/literary hangover.
And of course, Jamie, who is not here today, is also, you can find the Antifada.
Look at you. You're like a little mini progressive godfather over here.
It's created a whole little factory system.
It's like the cedar industries.
It's crazy. Everybody's got a podcast now. And then they go on Hayes' show, and he's just like, I'm in the podcast game now. I'm like, well, dude.
Say, shut up, Chris.
If it's one day a week, forget it. You're not in the game. Get into the game. 5 days a week podcast. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number for the show. And, of course, you can IM via our app, which you can find at majorityapp.com. Quick break, then to the fun half.
She said